Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Robert Louis Stevenson called the area around the Monterey Peninsula the greatest meeting of land and sea. Indeed, the Monterey coast is spectacular. But one landscape that's hidden from view lies deep below the ocean and is partly responsible for the incredible diversity of marine life in the bay. It's the Great Submarine Canyon that plunges from the shore at Moss Landing to the deep ocean bottom. The bay has always drawn fascination from marine biologists and ecologists, most famously Doc Ricketts, the close friend of John Steinbeck, whose home and lab on Cannery Row is preserved to this day. In that tradition, scientists from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which is a separate entity from the aquarium in Monterey, and it's based in Moss Landing, study the submarine canyon from top to bottom. And three of them join us today to tell us about their work. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Jim Berry, who studies benthic organisms that inhabit the bottom of the canyon and cling to its walls. Then, Bruce Robeson will tell us about the strange and diverse life forms that swim in the waters deep below the surface of the bay, from great whales to giant squid and octopi. Finally, Craig Daw will tell us about how he came to be one of the operators of the robotic operating vehicles that probe the depths of the bay with their cameras and instruments, giving the scientists unparalleled access to this mysterious undersea world. But first up, let's get a tour of the canyon and its processes from a scientist who perhaps knows it better than anyone. Geologist Charles Paul has been a senior scientist at the Monterey Bay Research Institute, aka MBARI, since 1999. His studies of the turbidity currents that shape the canyon have revolutionized our understanding of these mysterious currents that deposit sediments and organic materials from the continents into the deep ocean. He joined us via Skype from Moss Landing. Charlie Paul, welcome to Blue Dot. So I'm thinking about what you do, and I'm just getting insanely envious because, you know, some of my favorite things are geology, the ocean, and I think the most beautiful place on earth is Monterey Bay. So, you know, how did you get that gig? I'd like to do that.
With incredible luck. I've been very fortunate to have the position to be a research scientist at a nonprofit think tank that's dedicated to studying the ocean and developing new tools and techniques to do so.
You are an expert on the Monterey Bay Submarine Canyon, which just has always fascinated me. So could you begin by just give us an overview on what this submarine canyon is and how big it is?
Well, the size of it is frequently compared to the Grand Canyon, and it's a pretty good analogy, except for the sides of Monterey Canyon in places are actually steeper than the Grand Canyon, and the actual amount of material that's been excavated from the ground to form it is slightly larger, and it runs 450 kilometers, which is considerably further than the main sections of the Grand Canyon.
Well, you know, let's talk about the processes that have created this canyon, because, you know, when you talk about the Grand Canyon, you've got the uplift of the Colorado Plateau there and the cutting action of the Colorado River. What formed this giant canyon just off the coast there in Monterey?
Well, of course, there isn't a river, and there's never been a river flowing through the bottom of Monterey Canyon. But there are processes that are, in some regards, similar. And these are phenomena that are called turbidity flows or sediment gravity flows. They're somewhat analogous to avalanches in mountain ranges. And unlike rivers, these are events which are gonna go down through the sinuous bottom of the canyon. They surge, they're pretty high energy, and they're actually very poorly known because very difficult to observe their passage. You know, if you think about the canyon, it's underwater, it's out of sight. Reasonable technology even to realize the canyon is there at all.
So when was the canyon first discovered?
Well, very early mapping by the Spanish explorers discovered that there were remarkably deep water closer to shore than you would think. And it was a progressive thing with sounding lines that were collected through the 1800s that probably demarked it as being a canyon-like shape. One of the pioneers of submarine canyon research, Fran Shepard, made the first really good map of Monterey Canyon. That's a long time ago. That was well before World War II. And, you know, of course, we progressively make better and better maps of it, going from things that are simply realizing the feature is there at all to levels of resolution now that are approaching each data point on a map represents an area which is no more than 1 meter by 1 meter and 10 centimeters high.
And how does this canyon compare to, is it one of the largest, as I understand?
Yes, it's a candidate for being the largest on the Pacific coast of the U.S.
Wow. Okay, you talked earlier about turbidity currents, and I understand that that's something that you especially study. Could you explain to us what is a turbidity current?
If you mix up water with sediment and were to pour it into another tank of water that didn't have the sediment, it would flow down into the bottom of the tank because it's denser. You know, and the same thing happens in the ocean whenever you get some phenomena that has stirred up or provided water that has increased amounts of sediment in it. That water will be heavier, and then that water will naturally tend to flow downslope. In the process of flowing down slope, it'll get captured in the canyon systems. There's a convergence of flows, sometimes from several directions, that get channeled into these canyons.
And they are in a big way responsible for carving these canyons out, as I understand it. One of the things I was curious about is that I was looking at an article that featured your research where you found out some things about turbidity currents that were really not understood before. Could you tell us a bit about what you discovered?
I mean, going through recent years, because we've discovered that there are events of turbidity current events, using that as a broad term, that happen with a frequency in Monterey Canyon that's subannual. There are three or four of them that happen every year. So that has enabled us to study them with the intent of capturing the flows as they happen. So we've been learning about the passage of these flows through the canyon system, about when they occur, how thick they are, what the turbulent cloud is above the bottom, and something about how the bottom itself gets reorganized as the flows go over them. And we've seen both from repeat mapping direct observations that large objects move in the bottom and that the bottom of the canyon gets reshaped substantially during these events. So you'll see certain places in the bottom that will go up by meters or down by meters. And in fact, the range which commonly occurs is they'll go up by 2.5-3 meters and down by 2.5-3 meters between repeated surveys.
And can you give us an idea of why are these turbidity currents and the creation of this canyon, why is this such an important thing to understand in terms of the interaction between the land and the ocean?
Well, fundamentally, if you think about how material moves across the surface of the Earth, we can attribute the fact that plate tectonics pushes up the continents and the mountains. Erosion weathers it down. The sediment that's weathered off the mountains and the landscape drains to the shoreline in the river systems. And we know a tremendous amount about how that material moves in the rivers. But when it gets to the shoreline, in order to basically balance the sediment budgets of the world, a nearly equivalent amount of material will get funneled into these conduits and taken out into the deep sea and the like. So the canyons and the channels that go across the seafloor are fundamental conduits for movements. And in some regards, we know very little about what actually happens in them, other than we know that the material will enter at the top, geologically it will come out at the bottom, but what happens along the way has been unclear. So, scientifically, that's a kind of a large theme in understanding the Earth. If you want to look at more practical reasons for studying them. They carry a lot of organic carbon. The material which is coming down has got organic carbon that's coming from the from the land, you know, plant material. Some of it's partly digested, but that organic carbon is going to go out into the deep sea and is probably a very important factor for feeding the deep sea communities, or at least it's a factor that we need to understand better. There are also these flows can be quite destructive to any infrastructure that goes across the seafloor. You know, it could be submarine communications cables, and we need to know about that in order to direct what goes on with seafloor infrastructures. And of course, the final reason has to do with the fact that the deposits that are laid down by turbidity currents are the main deposits in which oil and gas has been found. So there's been considerable interest in studying the deposits that are associated with them for the practical reason that oil companies are basically looking for deposits associated with turbidity currents.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our look at the Great Submarine Canyon below Monterey Bay with Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute senior scientist Charlie Paul. This is Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's resume our look at Monterey Bay Submarine Canyon through the eyes of geologist Charlie Paul from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Earlier, you talked about the spatial resolution you have of these maps. And, you know, when I think of undersea mapping, of course, you think of sonar, you know, a ship bouncing sound waves off the bottom and then getting the return signal and making maps that way. What are some of the other instruments that you use to really get a handle on mapping this canyon?
Well, let me just say that we're still primarily using acoustic techniques, and the systems that we have pushed to get to high resolution that we do routinely, and the resolution that I told you about of the 1 meter by 1 meter by 10, 11 centimeter in a vertical direction, we're doing that acoustically. The trick for that is by flying our sonars near the bottom, by getting our sonars down within 50 meters of the bottom when we collect the data, we're able to achieve higher resolution in the stuff. So this has been done using autonomous underwater vehicles, which is something that Bari has been very active in developing, these torpedo-like tools that are completely pre-programmed, that are released from a ship, that descend down to the seafloor, lock in about 50 meters off the bottom, and set out to collect bathymetric data by running patterns that are about like mowing the lawn, but flying up and over the topography at this 50-meter elevation. They'll conduct the whole mission on their own, and then eventually float back to the surface and transmit to you that they're back at the surface and ask to come for you to come pick them up.
Wow, so they're like little sonar drones flying around down there over the ocean floor.
They're very much so. They're actually about torpedo-sized also, the ones that we're using, so that they're not little, but they are completely pre-programmed robotic vehicles.
Wow, and then do you also use the remotely operated vehicles?
Well, the remotely operated vehicles are used a lot here. We primarily use them because they're first and foremost, eyeballs. I mean, remotely operated vehicle, of course, is connected to the ship by a cable, and you get telemetry and power going down through the cable system to the bottom. The first advantage of this is you can image the bottom and you can move around with the vehicle while you're directing it and sample the seafloor. You started this question by asking about mapping. There are efforts underway at Mbari to do even more detailed mappings by putting some of these systems directly on an ROV, which again can fly back and forth across the seafloor, this time even closer, just a couple of meters off the bottom, which again increases your resolution. So you can use those tools to get at the resolution that was now approaching 5 centimeters in a map, which is startling in comparison with what they used to do with lead lines.
Wow. Yeah, that's really accurate. Another thing I saw, and of course, when you mentioned Mbari, for our listeners, that's the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which is where you work, which is a separate entity from the aquarium where people love to go and see the incredible displays and tanks there. That's just amazing. But the Research Institute, that's in Moss Landing, right?
Correct. Correct. We're 25 kilometers up the road from the aquarium. Grew out of the aquarium and is still sister organization with the aquarium, but our emphasis is on research. And again, we focus on developing new tools and technology to do the research. So we're always trying to couple science that's worth doing with technology that's worth developing.
And one of those technologies that I saw a picture of you looking out at this platform. It contained a bunch of things that look kind of like metallic beach balls, is the only way I could think of to describe them. And they were called electronic boulders, and you use those to actually map some of these turbidity currents that they kind of turn on automatically when they start getting moved around on the bottom. Could you tell us a bit about those? Because I found that fascinating.
Yes, yeah, so these devices, which we actually call benthic event detectors or BEDs, these are boulders that we like to think of as smart boulders. They're usually housed in a beach ball-sized synthetic housing that inside them contains an electronic package. And as you indicated, this electronic package is capable of measuring motion. And what we do is take these objects out with an ROV, we bury them a short distance in the seafloor, and they do almost nothing until they experience an acceleration that's some fraction of a G, and whereupon they wake up. And they measure their orientation, and they do that at a fairly fast rate, at 50 hertz, where you'll get the orientation, you'll get the pressure, and you get the time. And with this data, when you put them on the floor of the canyon, and a turbidity current comes over top of them, they will move down through the canyon system. And our record runner went 9 kilometers in 57 minutes, and we were able to record the passage of it and learn about the processes that are in the bottom of the canyon as they go down.
And so what was the most surprising thing you learned from the results from watching these smart boulders rolling down the canyon?
Well, we're learning about the structure of the bottom, how the bottom moves, when it moves, how far it moves, how long, how thick the section is that moves, as these events occur.
And of course, the fact that canyon is there, that very deep water is right off the coast and in the bay, creates just a dramatic biological chain event, doesn't it? Because that's what makes it such a historically rich fishery.
Well, part of that is this upwelling all on the sides of the canyon that definitely stimulates the fisheries. That's why whale watching is so good in Moss Landing, because the whales come right into the head canyon head to feed. And it's It's a profound topographic feature in the biology as well as the geology.
Wow. What's your favorite thing about your job? What do you enjoy the most about being a geologist working there at Mbari?
Well, it's a luxury to be able to come in to work every day and just follow your own interests of research and do it in an environment that you pretty much decide what you do yourself.
And do you yourself go out on research vessels out in the bay very often? Or is everything pretty much done remotely?
I go out to sea a fair amount. Most years I go to sea more than 60 days.
Wow. And how far out do you go when you're studying the canyon? How far out does the canyon go?
We rarely go more than 100 kilometers out. In fact, most of the time if we're going to sea to study the canyon, we don't go more than 50 kilometers out, because that's the covers the upper part of the canyon where most of our process studies are being done.
And so does the canyon basically end? It begins right near Moss Landing, right? And does it end basically at the deep ocean floor? Or is that still part of the continent?
Yeah, the canyon goes down onto what you would call the deep ocean floor. There's a well-developed channel. And we get into a little bit of a semantic question because we have the canyon, and the canyon will go into the Monterey Fan Channel. But that channel continues out at least 450 kilometers. And honestly, the channel is still formed as far out as there is a good map. So we don't even know quite how far it really goes because it's a pretty subtle feature.
Oh, and that kind of leads me to my next question. One of my last questions is, what are some of the big mysteries that you're working on? What are some of the things, the big questions you have that you're studying now? Some things you'd like to understand about the bay and the canyon that you don't understand fully?
Well, I'd love to see our technologies to be able to map it in a repetitive way so we can track relatively small-scale changes in the seafloor. And a theme that we're sort of pushing here that's both associated with the canyon and other features is to be able to make maps which are adequately quantitative so we can track changes that are going on in the seafloor at a high enough level so you can really quantify geologic processes in a time scale that might match the tenure of a graduate student or a postdoc or certainly a career. And so many geologic processes have been viewed as so slow that they're just been seen as being too static to measure. But I think we're in the process of changing that and being able to actually make quantitative maps that we can see small scale changes that might be associated with things that could be biological, like the effects of bioturbation and worms on the bottom, to sediment flows like the ones that I've been talking about, to creeping sides of a canyon or where it would be slumping off, or to the potential creeping or small movements that may be happening with faults.
Yeah, there's a large fault system that runs through there too. Isn't that the San Gregorio Hosmer fault system that runs through the canyon?
Yes, and we've spent some time trying to find this particular fault. We have very good luck finding faults elsewhere, but we see no evidence where this fault is mapped to occur, that it's actually displaced sediments that are Holocene in age or sediments that are less than 10,000 years old. So I don't think it's moved, based on those observations, appreciably in geologically recent times.
Well, people often find fault in me, but good luck with finding fault there.
Well, thank you.
Well, Charlie Paul, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Charlie Paul's a geologist, a senior scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Thanks so much for sharing your wealth of knowledge about the submarine canyon below Monterey Bay.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute senior scientist geologist Charlie Paul. Next up, we'll look at what kinds of things live on the bottom and the walls of the submarine canyon with Jim Berry. Dr. Berry studies the biology and ecology of the benthic or bottom-dwelling organisms of the ocean. He joined us from Moss Landing via Skype. Jim Berry, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're doing this program about the submarine canyon in the Monterey Bay, and you're a benthic researcher, which means you study organisms on the bottom of the ocean, right?
That's correct. Benthic ecology or benthic research is usually focusing on organisms that live on the seafloor.
Mm-hmm. So I would like you to just, you know, for somebody who doesn't, like if you were talking to a relative or somebody that wants to know what you do, and you tell them, well, I research benthic organisms in the Monterey Bay, the submarine canyon. How would you characterize life in the canyon at the bottom for them?
Well, for life in the canyon, it's an interesting place because the canyon, much like many canyons, has a start ahead of the head of the canyon, and then it tails off for hundreds of miles offshore. And animals that live in the canyon have to contend with all of the normal environmental factors of depending upon where they live. Most of them live either on the walls of the canyon that could be mudstone or rock outcrops. They may live on the bottom of the canyon and be subject to turbidity flows or underwater landslides that could bury them. So there are differences in where animals live depending upon how frequent and intense those sediment transport events or turbidity flows may be. They have to contend with the cold, dark conditions, find food just like most other animals must find food, either by capturing things that are floating past as filter feeders or filtering water in another way as suspension feeders, predators running from prey. The same sorts of challenges that most animals under almost any condition experience, so do those animals that live on the seafloor.
One of the things I found fascinating is the size range of the organisms that live on the bottom. Could you give us a sense of the range of sizes of things that live down there in the bottom?
Oh, sure. Well, there are anything from the microbes, of course, to small crustaceans that tend to colonize, or small worms that tend to colonize areas that are heavily disturbed. So they're the first in because they have larvae that can land in an area, and they're sort of the weeds of the deep sea, if you want to put it that way, all the way to large animals like sleeper sharks or seven-gill sharks or giant deep sea corals that inhabit areas that are far more stable and aren't going to be subject to some of these turbidity flows that you find in Monterey Canyon.
Are there any organisms that live in the Monterey Bay Canyon that are really unique and specific to that particular environment?
Yeah, I'd say yes and no. If you look at most of the animals that inhabit the canyon, most of those are found up and down the coast, and especially as you move into deeper water, the water's cold everywhere, all the way from Alaska all the way down to the tropics. So there's often a larger geographic range north and south for animals that are in the deep sea than you might find for shallower water animals, where it's cold water off the coast of Washington and Oregon and a little bit warmer in Southern California. And so you see large differences there. But as far as some of the kind of the animals that live in the canyon that don't, or rather are not found commonly elsewhere, I'd probably focus on those that inhabit methane seeps that are found in the canyon. And as the canyon or Monterey Canyon or other canyons erode, they cut into the local substratum, the local geologic formation. In this area, it happens to be a methane-bearing stratum or methane-bearing formation that methane can be used by microbes that support life, called chemosynthesis, instead of what we see at the surface called photosynthesis. And so there are some really odd worms and snails and clams that inhabit parts of Monterey Canyon at these areas where methane is seeping from the seabed or available at the seabed, and they're found nowhere else. They're very much like the animals that inhabit hydrothermal vents, where there's sulfide-rich fluid seeping from the seafloor.
Wow, and that sounds interesting. When we talk about searching for life beyond Earth, often, you know, the talk is about the analogies between Earth's hydrothermal systems and the deep sea around the mid-ocean ridges, and perhaps places like that with those methane deposits.
That's right. They're fascinating animals that originally started as normal feeding animals in the clams in particular that inhabit these sites in Monterey Bay, they have lineage to normal clams, but they're quite different in their physiology. So clams normally make a living by filtering seawater past their gills, and they exchange carbon dioxide and oxygen just like we do in our lungs, but they would also trap particles. And as they trap those particles, they sort them out, spit out the unsuitable food called pseudofeces, and then they swallow the good stuff. For these clams, they have really large gills. They still filter water just like normal clams do, but they have a very reduced gut. They don't live off the material they filter, and instead, they have a compound in their blood where they stick their foot, and all clams have a foot so that they can dig through the sediments, and they'll stick their foot down into sulfide-rich deposits that are just a few inches below the seabed and take up sulfide, carry that to their gills, and deliver it to bacterial symbionts that live in their gills. And they actually have large gills that are in which they're farming these bacteria that are growing from the sulfide they use, running chemosynthesis to take carbon dioxide plus water, and using chemical energy rather than solar energy, they're creating sugars and then the organic materials that they would normally gain from feeding. And the clam makes a living through this symbiosis by grazing on those bacteria that it has in its gills. And so it's good for the bacteria because they have the perfect site to live with the sulfide delivered to them, like a butler bringing a tray of appetizers. Yet the butler is also consuming them by grazing on those bacteria. So that's how the clam makes a living. Very different from the normal clams that we see in the deep sea or on the shoreline.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jim Berry as we talk about the life forms at the bottom of the sea in Monterey Bay. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's finish our conversation with Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute biologist Jim Berry. What occurs to me is the usual question, how do we know that? How do you go about studying that? What kind of instruments do you use to understand what's going on in a place like that?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And part of it is knowing what to look for, and part of it is trying to figure out the puzzle once you've found them. And in this case, in Monterey Bay, or elsewhere in the world when these clams were first discovered, or if hydrothermal vent animals were first discovered, the discovery came about when we were down in a submarine or video or samples came up from the depth and we found these giant deep sea clams. In this case, these clams get to around 6 or 8 inches long. In the deep sea, most of the clams you find might be up to an inch long. So you don't find animals like that in the deep sea very often. And in this case, in Monterey Bay, we were actually transiting along with the ROV and we saw a clam shell that was a large clam shell and decided, wait a minute, that's an anomaly. There should not be a large clam shell in the deep sea like this unless it's a seep clam, because we knew from other studies that those kinds of animals only inhabited those seeps. So we said, well, let's look uphill a little bit because this was just a shell. And we thought it probably fell down the hillside. Even though it's underwater, it's still a hillside and things roll downhill just like they do as you crawl up a hillside around your home. So we moved the ROV up the hill a little bit and sure enough, we found the concentration of the live clams and realized that this was a specialized system. once we found these, and through our work and others that studied these clams, then you start to put together the puzzle that really started with hydrothermal vents. How are these giant animals making a living in such a food-poor area? Something else has to be going on. And through physiological studies that we've done, other people had done to try and determine how these animals are making a living, we made these discoveries that identified that they were using these bacterial symbioses to make a living. And that involved a variety of measurements, things like looking at the stable isotopic signature of the carbon and nitrogen in the shells, or trying to determine what sort of physiological pathways they may have through their enzyme systems, or through just simply do they have a gut or not? So there's a lot that goes into it, but it's sort of a fascinating puzzle when you start to try and understand how this particular organism is going from a larva, somehow gaining food, and then turning into an adult that's reproducing.
Yes, and that's just one part, a very interesting, fascinating part of the submarine canyon ecosystem. Could you just give us briefly an overview on the kind of the food web going on there in the canyon?
Sure. Well, the canyon, or all canyons, are really interesting places in terms of how the animals there make a living. And of course, all animals need to find some food source, whether it's the chemosynthesis-based system that we just talked about, or if it's normal feeding trophic interactions that, or feeding webs that most animals are involved with. All of the deep sea, except at these very exceptional places like hydrothermal vents, all animals or organisms in the deep sea depend upon the rain of organic debris that's coming from surface waters. And in the top 200 meters or so of the water column, that's where all of the plant life occurs. That's where all the photosynthesis takes place, which is the base of the food chain. And that's not any different for animals inhabiting the canyon. Most of the ocean, there's this rain of organic debris, and somehow that material is sinking from the surface down to the deep sea, all the while being consumed by the myriad of animals that inhabit the midwaters of the ocean. And finally, it hits the bottom of the ocean, and the deeper it is, the less material or less food value there is in the material that's landing on the deep sea. Canyons, however, are a unique conduit for material that, instead of sinking vertically from the surface to the bottom, can also make its way down the canyon laterally as debris flows move down the canyon. So there's lots of food that actually lands at the head of the canyon through currents that move it up and down the coastline, and things like kelp or debris that's coming out of kelp beds or other debris coming out of estuaries can hit the head of a canyon and then slide downslope, feeding the animals that live along the canyon walls or at the base of the canyon. So many animals actually feed from material that's carried in from elsewhere, not just sinking down from the surface, but carried laterally down the canyon walls or down the canyon axis.
Could you maybe real quick, I know this is hard, but could you also give us a sense of how climate change is affecting life in the deep ocean there at the canyon?
Sure. That's actually what I focus on more than anything else, is trying to understand how changes in ocean conditions that are linked to climate change might affect animals in shallow water as well as the deep sea. And although what we see in the surface waters is, as far as climate-related changes in ocean conditions are happening first, they are definitely penetrating all the way to the bottom of all of the world ocean, and it'll take more time, but they're getting there. And what we're seeing is certainly heat. Most of the heat from global warming is already in the ocean, and that's what heats the most. In addition to warming the ocean, we see changes in ocean acidity because of the excess burden of CO2 that's dissolving from the atmosphere related to our fossil fuel emissions into the ocean. And that's acidifying or reducing the pH or increasing the acidity of ocean waters, mainly at the surface right now, but that's also penetrating to deeper water. As you warm the ocean surface, it reduces the amount of mixing of surface waters toward the deeper ocean, and that means less oxygen is getting into the deep waters of the ocean, because one of the major mechanisms to move oxygen from the surface to the deep sea is through wind-driven mixing of ocean waters. The only location oxygen enters the ocean is at the surface. So all of the oxygen within the deeper waters of the ocean is being consumed slowly and replaced slowly through these mixing processes. Reduce the mixing processes a little bit, and you reduce the level of oxygen that's being injected into the deep sea, and that can lead to reductions in oxygen levels that can be stressful for a variety of animals. And that's happening right off our coast here.
Oh, not a good thing. Well, again, Jim, I really appreciate your time today and your expertise. It was fascinating to learn about what goes on at the bottom of the ocean there in Monterey Bay.
It is. Thanks for your time. I appreciate you inviting me on.
Next up, let's learn about some of the diverse life forms that inhabit the depths of the ocean in the submarine canyon of Monterey Bay with Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute midwater biologist Bruce Robeson. He joined us via Skype from Mbari in Moss Landing. Bruce Robeson, welcome to Blue Dot. And so you study what's called the mesopelagic fauna. So meso, of course, means middle, and pelagic is the ocean, right? So you study the middle part of that water column, right?
Now I do the whole thing. Mesopelagic, there's bathypelagic, there's abyssopelagic. Anything that lives between the surface and the deep sea floor, for me, is fair game.
Wow. And I, when you know, when I think about what you study, I think about the times I'm out on the ocean or just off the coast in a boat, and I always think about, oh, what are the weird things that live down there? And of course, I grew up reading Jules Verne and all kinds of things like that, and giant squids and octopi. And you study those really interesting creatures down there. Could you tell us about some of the more interesting creatures that live down there in Monterey Bay submarine canyon?
That habitat, that vast deep habitat, is very challenging. At least it seems that way to us. It's cold, it's dark. The deeper you go, the higher the pressure gets. The deeper you go, the farther away you are from the base of the food web. And yet the animals that live there are perfectly well adapted to those strange and apparently harsh conditions. But in the process of adapting to the habitat, they have come up with some means of dealing with the challenges that appear to us to be pretty strange, pretty unusual, not the least of which is bioluminescence. These animals, for the most part, communicate principally with light that they produce themselves. I think it's safe to say that bioluminescence is the most widespread form of communication on Earth. And yet we humans are just beginning to understand the fundamentals of this language, this means of communication. And it's a very widespread phenomenon, and one that's fascinating to try to understand.
And some of the colors are, you know, to use a 60s term, just like psychedelic. They're amazing, strange colors that some of these creatures put out, aren't they?
The colors of the animals themselves are often very striking. But that's the way it appears to us when we go down there with our white lights and shine white light on them. In deep water, the only wavelengths of sunlight that penetrate deep are in the blue range. As a consequence, only blue light is available, and virtually all the bioluminescence produced by the animals that live down there is in the blue wavelength range itself. That's because blue light travels farthest through seawater. The point is, when we shine our white lights on animals and see red ones and orange ones and brown ones, they look very colorful to us. But in the natural lighting of that habitat, where only blue light is available, the red or brown or yellow pigments in those animals absorb all of the light that's available. They eat up all of the blue light that's the only light present at that depth. And as a consequence, the animals themselves are virtually invisible.
And of course, down there, there are large squids and octopi, aren't there?
Yes. We see big Humboldt squid here in Monterey Bay. We know that there are Architeuthis, the giant squid, also in this area. But those are large, fast-swimming, powerful animals. And if they don't want us to see them, then chances are we won't. Those like the Humboldt squid, which are pretty aggressive and will go anywhere for a meal, don't seem to be shy around humans in submersibles or in robotic or using robotic systems. So they'll come right up to the white light source. But the colossal squid or the giant squid are much more shy when it comes to situations like that. And so some of those critters we can see, others avoid us.
Tell us a bit about the food web down there. What are some of the, like, for example, the apex predators down in the deep ocean? And just describe the food chain for us as you get below the level where the light really penetrates.
The processes that provide food for that giant food web of the open ocean start, of course, in the surface waters where sunlight can stimulate photosynthesis. But food getting down into these deep habitats usually travels by a couple of methods. One is that many animals actively transport carbon and other nutrients down to depth. There's a process that takes place every evening and every morning. When the sun goes down, many of the animals that live in deep, dark water move up to the surface layers to feed at night. When the sun comes back up in the morning, they move back down into deep water. And so the transport of food by those animals is done actively. They swim up, they swim down. Another way that food gets down into the deep water column is through sinking of particles and dead bodies and poop and molted shells and things like that. All sorts of stuff that occurs and is sourced in the upper layers sinks down into the water column and ultimately to the seafloor to provide food for other critters. One of the things that we've discovered here recently is that instead of the slowly sinking, very small particles that used to be sort of the standard for what everybody thought of as the rain of detritus, we now have discovered that there are big, fast-sinking packages of organic matter that travel very rapidly to the seafloor. And that is something that has happened it's been going on in the ocean for a long time. We were just unaware of it because we weren't down there to see it. One final way that food gets transported downward is through die-offs of animals that occur near the surface. There are groups of gelatinous animals that can have giant blooms and consume all the food in the area and then die and sink rapidly to the seafloor. So virtually all of the food that's available to the animals in the deep water column originates in the surface layers. But there are a variety of ways that it gets down to the animals that live deep.
What makes Monterey Bay such a unique ecosystem and laboratory for you to study? What makes it different from a lot of other places along the West Coast?
One of the great features of Monterey Bay is that enormous submarine canyon. It brings deep water very, very close to shore. And That means that our access to that habitat and to the animals there that we want to study is pretty easy. The canyon itself, aside from being very convenient for us researchers who want to study the deep sea, the canyon acts as a conduit for nutrients that fertilize the upper layers of the ocean. It's also a conduit for deep living open ocean animals that wanna follow up on food sources, and it allows them a highway into this very rich region that's in the pocket of Monterey Bay along the coast. So it's the canyon itself is a great advantage for us who want to study the deep sea. And it's also advantageous for deep sea animals who want access to food resources that occur close to shore.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. It was fascinating. And Bruce Robeson, I can't imagine what it must be like to you watch a lot of this stuff on video on screens, right? What's it like to be just watching and see something really mysterious that you've never seen before pop on that screen?
It's a challenge. It's a puzzle, and your mind goes through the processes that you might imagine. Like, what the heck is that? And you start trying to put pieces together to recognize some sort of a pattern that resembles something you've seen before, so that you can try to begin to make sense of what it is you're seeing. But in my case, since I've been fortunate enough to spend a great deal of time down in the habitat myself using submersibles, when I'm watching something on a screen, I can reflect back on what I've seen with my own eyes directly and put a three-dimensional perspective onto something that comes across on video as just two dimensions.
We hope you enjoyed our voyage to the bottom of the sea. I used to love that show as a kid, in Monterey Bay, and our exploration of its submarine canyon. Thanks for listening, and thanks so much to our guests from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, geologist and senior scientist Charlie Paul, benthic ecologist and marine biologist Jim Berry, and midwater ecologist and marine biologist Bruce Robeson. Thanks also very much to Mr. Kim Fulton Bennett from Mbari for facilitating these interviews. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out and share this and past episodes on mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us, Blue Dot, on NPR Podcasts. We're distributed via PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I'm Dave Schlohm, reminding you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.